You're listening to an iFanboy Book Explode on Dark Knight, a true Batman story.
These days my friends don't seem to know me. Without my suitcase in my hand. And when I'm standing still, I seem to disappear.
Hello, welcome to a special iFanboy Booksplode episode. We haven't done one of these in years.
We're back. We're at your insistence.
The pick of the week is...
Oh. As part of our new Patreon, we have one of the rewards. One of the reward levels was we would add a Talksplode and a Booksplode show each month. And last month, Josh talked to Gabriel Hardman and Karina Becko for a Talksplode. This month, we're doing a Booksplode. And for new listeners, Booksplode is when we take a look at a single graphic novel or collected edition and talk about it for about half an hour or so. And really dive deep. I think we haven't done one of these since the aborted run on Starman. It's been a while.
All right. Yep.
It's been many years. So this is Dark Knight, a true Batman story. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Ron Richards.
Hello.
And Josh Flanagan.
Did they ever finish Starman, though? I mean, is that on us?
I mean...
The shows or the book? They didn't finish the book.
Is it ever really finished?
There you go. Artistic journeys.
It's an organic thing. So this is, we're looking at Dark Knight, a True Batman Story, which was an original graphic novel published by Vertigo, DC Comics. It came out this year, written by Paul Dini and drawn by Eduardo Risso. And in just a full disclosure, most people probably don't know that for a while, Paul Dini had a column on iFanboy.
Yes. Former iFanboy staffer, which I noticed they neglected to mention in his bio.
Not in his bio, is it?
Yeah. Come on, Paul.
Wow. I completely forgot that. I was trying to remember our connections to him. I was like, well, we talked about him on the show a lot, but there was something else.
We talked to him on the show a lot. We talked to his wife on the show a lot. We talked to his sock puppet, his wife's sock puppet on the show a lot. And I think out of pity, he wrote a very, very short column for us.
200 words with Paul Dini, which... It was a really great column I enjoyed for many... It actually ran a long time on the site. I think maybe about...
It really did, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Much longer than Jonathan Hickman's column.
Yes.
Centric circles.
So we had a Paul Dini column, very short-lived. If he walked into the room right now, he wouldn't know who I was. So there's no favoritism here.
I think it would take very little prompting, whereas others it would take a longer time. I think it's the short amount of time before he goes, oh, yeah.
Right, sure.
Let's talk about the book.
Anyway, let's talk about the book. Also, in the interest of full disclosure, I did not – you recommended this – we started talking about this book when it came out.
Yes.
And I did not – there's several things I did not know. Okay.
Well, that was going to be my first question about for you guys, so that's good.
I did not know it existed. Mm-hmm. I did not know that Eduardo Risso drew it. Mm-hmm. I did not know that it was a Vertigo book. I did not know that it was a Vertigo book with Batman in the title and on the cover. And I do not know why everyone isn't talking about this book, because it was delightful. This book was amazing.
Josh, did you know about it?
No, I did not. And you said, I want to read this book called The Dark Knight by Paul Dini. And in my head, I went, oh,
right. Yes.
I thought you were just making me read some Batman book, and then, should have given you more credit.
Yes.
And then I looked at the title and it said it was a true Batman story. I'm like, oh, so it's going to be about somebody in Batman and blah, blah, blah. I did not know the scope of this book. I did not know the hook. And why wasn't this everywhere? Well, did I miss that?
That one, that might be a little our fault.
Yeah, maybe.
So, I mean, I guess we're making up for it now. I will say the same thing. I started this and I thought, I was about two or three pages in and I went, oh.
Yeah.
And before we get any farther,
well, no, it was oh, and then like 20 pages was like oh,
no, it's not even. I just like I asked you guys earlier because I wasn't sure if I had time to read. I was like, well, how long is it? Whatever. It was one of the most compulsive page turners that I have read, certainly from Marvel or DC, in a very long time.
I read it in one sitting.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to. You really can't put it down.
Yeah.
This is an autobiographical tale, and the reason I knew about it is because Paul Dini did a lot of press on it originally when it was originally solicited. A lot of mainstream interviews because he's a low level media figure, but he's a name that gets he's linked to Batman cartoon.
He's got a great pedigree. I mean, yeah, Batman, Lost, iFanboy.
He did some mainstream interviews. I saw the interview. So this is a original graphic novel about, well, it's about him, but the hook is that when he was a writer producer on Batman in 1993, when he was 36
Batman
years old,
Batman the Animated Series.
Batman the Animated Series. He was 36 years old. He was viciously assaulted on the street and beaten very badly, and it's been something that's been plaguing him his entire life. And this that's the hook is that's the main driving force of this story, is that the before and after of that incident and how it has affected his life and how his imagination and his writing, how it all ties together. It's kind of an autobiography in a way, because he started him as a kid and he goes all the way through to the present day.
It's certainly a memoir.
It's a memoir. There's a little bit now, behind the scenes of Batman the Animated Series. It's, as he mentions in the book itself, it's not a story about the cartoon, which he knows people would want to read, but you do get a peek behind the scenes and how that show was made a little bit. And then it's about dealing with trauma. It's a lot about dealing with trauma.
I knew nothing. I literally knew nothing other than the cover going into the book. And I did that on purpose. I didn't, I didn't want to look at it. I just want to go to clean. And he starts it in a very innocent way, where it's really, he's giving his background and his, kind of how he got here and his, obsession or, interest in popular culture and Batman and cartoons and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, okay, but I don't really know where this is going. And there's a point in the book where he goes, a lot of you are probably hoping for more, a graphic novel about the making of Batman the Animated Series. This isn't it. And at that point I was like, it isn't. And then it gets to the incident. And like, what was funny was that the device that he used was, it's basically him, we're in a classroom or in a storyboard room, and he's pitching the story via, it's really storyboard room instead of classroom, but there was a projector at one point. But he's putting up on the wall storyboards of his life, and then it's just that in between, then Eduardo Risso illustrates them magnificently. And it just like Josh said, it pulled me in, and I could not put it down. Read it in one sitting.
One thing that really struck me is that we really loved Airboy last year, which was the James Robinson, Greg Hinkle Image miniseries that was a fantasy tale, but it was also very soul-searching on James Robinson's part. And we were admiring how he basically opened a vein up on the page and was very brutally honest about himself. And I thought the same thing was true in this. I mean, Paul takes you down some very tough roads. And he really explores his insecurities and his, I don't want to say his problems, but his issues. I mean, he wins an Emmy and then cuts himself with it.
That's the only page I read twice, because I was like, wait, is this what I want to do or what I did? And it was what he did, and I was like, oh wow, yeah.
And I was very, it was very brave of him, but it was, to me, it felt in that same vein of, wow, this is. The best art is when the artist is the most truthful, and this was him being very honest about who he was at that time. Anyway, but this is an utterly compelling book for that reason, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that he chose to do it now, because I mean, you could say that when you were talking about Airboy, for example, that James Robinson was in something of a transitional state when he did that book. It was sort of a reaction to him getting divorced. And his life changing and doing everything. So you can kind of see why he did that. But like Paul Dini sort of been a little quiet for a bit. I mean, maybe there is something going on. I don't know. But in terms of comics, I don't see him around a lot. He's probably working on stuff that I just don't know what it is. And so it seemingly came out of nowhere. And I don't know the guy at all. And I think that's what was like this is like, I know his work very well. We've spoken to him. We're acquaintances.
We've been admirers of his work for a long time.
Yeah, very much so.
Literally for decades, and he's the kind of person, and this kind of just, I mean, this comes as no surprise, but, literally for 10 years have seen him at conventions and in the context of this little comic book bubble world that we're in. I had no idea about this. Now, I'm sure that there are people that did know about it, or there are mutual acquaintances who knew about it or whatever, but whatnot, but never came up in conversation, didn't write a column about it, never really did any, so I literally had no idea. And the moment that I, it humanized him in a way that, that it never really had before. Like when you take that acquaintance and it gets expanded to a point of honesty and a point of truthfulness, that now I really respect the guy. I kind of want to give him a hug.
Yeah. Yeah.
He might recoil, which I think is fair. But
I mean, but I just at the end of it, he was super bold, and it made me go back and think about so much of his work. It made me think specifically of he did a great run on Detective Comics.
Yep.
Where they were, I don't know how long, let's say like a year. They were one and done stories, and it was one story about the Joker at Christmas, and it was a Robin story. And I started thinking about that in context of this story and sort of the terror. He wrote a really scary, really interesting Joker. Yep. And that sort of put everything into even more context. And for me, sometimes context can ruin art, but other times it can very much enhance it. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times, if you know like where a songwriter's coming from, you know where an artist's coming from, that gives you context for that work, and you can go, oh, I think I can kind of see where they're going now. And I think that tells a lot about how honest he was able to be with this, was sort of how close he was to being honest during those detective stories, which is odd because, as he made the point, like, who wants to write silly Batman stories? Well, but he found a reason to do it.
And that's what actually was the takeaway for me with this book, was it wasn't so much the fuel for his future stories or for the event and the situation, but it was his life afterwards, where, you know, he gets horribly assaulted and beat up, has surgery, can't go to work, and then he's healing, and I feel as if, and now I'm, you know, knock on wood, thank God, I've lived a mostly healthy life. I've never had surgery. I've never, you know, I've only been in the emergency room once in my life. I've never broken a bone, you know, so I can't really relate to real trauma from a physical standpoint. But if any, and even though I already knew this academically, if anything, this graphic novel pointed out to me is that there is an emotional and mental toll on this sort of trauma happening to somebody, and to see it manifest in him being unable to write these characters that he loves, was more devastating than it probably hurt a lot more to get beat up. But for me, like, that was the devastation part, and to watch him deal with that and then dig himself out of that is immensely respectful, and it was just amazing. And like, I was rooting for him at the end, like when he went back to work and he's like those pages on your desk, I'm working on this, I was like, yeah, Paul, go. I was like, because he got himself out of it, and he could have very easily succumbed to it and never gotten back.
This book, as much as anything, is a look at the PTSD. I mean, he has post-traumatic stress after that, and he still has it. He talks about at the end how he still flinches when people go near his face because he has some scars that he's ashamed of, and he also turns away when people come at him too quickly. He still has it, and he also talks about how he'll go months without even thinking about it, and then it'll be fresh in his mind and every detail, and he can't get it out of his head. This is classic post-traumatic stress, and I think if I remember correctly from the interviews, one of the reasons he wrote this is because, you know, a little bit of demon exercising, you know, get it out. But that, to me, that was an interesting part of the post, you know, because this is a 120 some odd page story. The attack happens around page 50. So, you've got as much post attack as you do pre. And there's a lot going on here. He's dealing with the PTSD. But as you said, Ron, he uses that as an impetus to clean up his life. I mean, you know, he's got a sad life beforehand, but he's very, very lonely, and he's being taken advantage of a lot by people. And he uses it as a chance to sort of look at himself, and he stops drinking as much, and he focuses on his career, and he finds although he doesn't find her in the book, he finds a great wife. And
yeah, we know that he's found happiness, you know, many, many years later, but it seemed as if in that moment he was in that weird spot of being young and hungry and in a position where work dominates your life, which is, you know, which I think we all know both from our own personal experience as well as friends and things like that, that is a real tough spot to be in. And, you know, he said, you know, the job writing Batman the Animated Series was, you know, often he's like, you couldn't maintain relationships because the work came first, which, you know, might explain a lot of Bruce Timm's dour demeanor, as masterfully documented in this book, where every time Bruce Timm is on a page, he's scowling. And I was like, good job, Riso. You nailed him.
Although he isn't the villain. It's Alan Burnett.
He's not.
He says Paul Dini says in the little foreword that Alan Burnett is not the sort of mean guy he's presented here, but I can imagine that in his memories of the time, he would come off as harsher than he actually was.
You know, what's funny is that I read that in the beginning, and I was kind of looking for it. And to me, like, Alan Burnett was like the most important person here outside of, you know, Paul himself.
Yeah.
Because really, in the end, he's written that way, but he had that wisdom to be like, you need to come back and start doing, you need to get back to your life. And he gave him what, in television, in the competitive world, like, he gave him a long rope.
Yes.
He's just struck me as extremely compassionate.
Oh yeah,
but in an indirect way.
You have to look beyond what's actually happening. I mean, also,
yeah.
The detail is that when this attack happens, they're not only in the middle of making the show, but they're in the middle of making Batman Mask of the Phantasm, and they have to do it in a year, which is insane on an animation schedule. But so they were working really, really hard, and basically one of their top writers dropped out for weeks at a time after he had been attacked. So Alan Burnett comes off as the surface-level, sort not villain, because clearly the attackers are...
Harry White.
But he has compassion, and especially at the end when he's back at work and he's letting him pitch the Sandman idea and letting him get it out because he knows he needs to.
Now, did you have a moment where you're like, wait, did that happen? Did I see that?
Well, there's actually little nuggets here if you're fans of the cartoon. There's a little bit behind the scenes tidbits. One of them is we get two aborted pitches. One is a Batman animated series idea in which Batman meets the Sandman and Death from Neil Gaiman's story. And the other one is a really creepy Batman Beyond pitch where Batman walls the Joker up in a little bunker in his Batcave and finally doesn't want to deal with him anymore in a very Edgar Allan Poe way. But so there's little bits. And actually, in addition to the PTSD, what you get here is an examination of the mind of an animation writer. And the reason why it's a Dark Knight True Batman story and why in the cover you've got Batman and the Joker looming over a beaten up Paul Dini is because in his mind, those were the two voices in his head. One was telling him to stand up and get himself together. The other telling him to succumb to the anger and the madness and the hurt feelings. So it's as much about the two angels on his shoulders as anything else. Just in his head, they manifest these ways.
And in between that, I thought there was some really, again, honest and just amazing, dialogue between Paul and Batman, which is basically where were you when I needed you? If you were real, this is what would have happened. But that's not, I thought, and it was funny because the more of the character, the more of the interaction between Paul and the characters themselves, I found myself sometimes coming close to eye rolling, but then remembering who it is and allowing it. I feel like no one aside from maybe Bruce Timm or Alan Burnett or some other folks, nobody really has the gravitas to pull that off. But Paul Dini definitely does. And at times it got chaotic because there are just so many villains and so many characters, and you realize how dialed in he is to these characters and how
absolutely when he was switching between characters, the villain voices were all very distinct.
Yep,
and very correct. And I was actually really impressed by that, because I think a lot of times people, like a major motion picture, for example, will conflate Two-Face and Joker. But Paul, Paul's having none of that. Paul's one of the best there is at that character, those characters.
And the thing is, people who go through trauma, and I've been victim of a crime, but nothing traumatic like Paul has. But everyone who goes through that has those voices in their heads that, well, maybe you should have done this, or maybe you should have done this differently. And it just so happens his manifest as Batman and the Joker because he's so, as you said, dialed into that. And he's working 24 hours a day on these characters. But that's the tug and pull everyone goes through in their minds afterwards is, what if I had done this differently? What if I had punched that guy? What if I had the judo throw that Batman suggests? It's just most people don't manifest it as a Batman on their shoulder. But it's the same thing everyone goes through.
One of the things that's interesting to me is I have this one of my pet peeves in life is men get this tough guy thing. Mm-hmm. It happens a lot, like I ride mountain bikes, right? And for a lot of people, there's a whole thing where people are like, be tough. What are you going to just fight through it? Do whatever. And I find that really irritating as sort of a male ethos. And one of the things I actually like about comics in general is that's not really, we know a lot of comics professionals and fans, and that's just not really part of the culture, which is kind of rad. And there's times where this is right on the edge of that, but it's almost like the good version of it, where Batman is telling him, in a way, suck it up, but not in a sort of dismissive way. Like, it's right at the edge of you need to, you need to deal with this because there's nobody's going to do it for you. There's nobody. And I thought he rode that line really, because there was times where I was like, shut up, Batman, let him be okay. But it was when he needed to hear it was when he needed to do things. And it was what I'm getting at is it was a good portrayal of the idea of masculinity to a certain extent, I think, that came through Batman talking to him in his mind.
So let's talk about Eduardo Risso.
Yeah, let's talk about him.
This is a tour de force, Ray Water.
I mean, and that was the other thing. So not only was the book Paul Dini and Fantastic and Batman, and we'll get to the Vertigo, the publishing aspect of it, but I didn't know Eduardo Risso was doing it. And my God, Eduardo Risso,
why did he do this? and I don't mean that to be dismissive, but I was like, this guy could do anything. He could literally he could go to Marvel or DC, and Eduardo Risso would be like, I want to do this, and they would be like, okay. But he did this, which is, I think, a really interesting choice, because it's not action-y. It's not, if you think about what a Risso sort of book looks like is very far from that. Maybe that's why, but I mean, a lot of it was just, you know, that Scott McCloud style understanding comics, Paul Dini talking to us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Really well done, but it was an interesting choice, I thought.
He gets to run the gamut of styles here.
Yeah.
You know, we're used to the very comics noir, shadow heavy, brilliant Eduardo Risso, but here he gets to do that a little bit, especially in the, it's, you know, in the mugging scene, that's the most recognizable Eduardo Risso. But, you know, you get cartoon work here, you get sketch, you know, when we see the stuff on the board in the beginning, you get really cartoony stuff, you get really sketchy stuff, you get stuff that looks like the animated series. It's, he's all over the style map here, which is great.
There was one other spot where I saw Eduardo Risso.
What's that?
Did you notice that the therapist was super fucking sexy?
Well, it's LA. It's LA. They're all.
There was like a Melfi thing to it. And then, yes, like later, yeah, she was really sexy. And I was like, there he is. He cannot help but make ladies sexy.
This is as lush visually as it is interesting story wise. He's someone we don't get to see a lot, I guess, because he was working on this 120 page graphic novel. But I was pouring over the pages.
I got to say, maybe this book didn't sell a lot or whatever, but Shelley Bond put this through and then they let her go.
Yeah.
That seems so stupid.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing, because I was like, how often do you see a Batman book at Vertigo? And that was the first thing that had me scratch my head. Then I realized, I'm like, oh, okay, this is autobiographical and all this sort of stuff, and it makes sense. But to put this through Vertigo, I guess because they're the only ones who really do graphic novels, but this didn't have to be a Vertigo book.
I think it was, I'm assuming there was a little idea about putting this on a mainstream DC book.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Attract the wrong audience, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not really it's a Vertigo. I mean, it's a very adult subject matter.
Yeah.
And they get to have fun with it. You know, there's a scene where he's at the shooting range because he's thinking about buying a gun after his attack. And so Batman gets to have a couple of shots and he says, DC would never let me do this in a comic.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they get to level of fun with the publisher.
Yeah, it's adult and that sort of thing. But man, I mean, and Riso's done Batman before.
Yeah, he did it for Wednesday Comics.
Yeah. Oh my God, I found myself after the sequence of Batman, what Batman would have done if he was there, or chasing the attackers in their car, and all, I was like, oh man, I want Riso on Batman.
Did that? What was the thing before the New 52? Flash.
It was the Flashpoint. Yes, that's what. Yes,
the 3-issue mini. Yep, it was really, really good 3-issue mini.
Yeah. Yep.
I was just blown away with this. I mean, I was looking forward to it. I don't think I was expecting this when I read it. You know what I mean?
When you had us read it, you had already read it, so you knew what we were in for.
Yes. It's been out for a couple months.
Good job on you, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, good job. Very good. Bravo.
Didn't say a word.
Yeah. Not even, like, I can't keep my mouth shut with this stuff. I'd be like, you got to read this. Did you read it? You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you played it
super cool.
Well, it's Connor. He's the captain. But... this is like I want to hand this to people. Like, this is yet again another great graphic novel that can go beyond the comic reading audience, that you can give to anybody dealing with PTSD, dealing with getting attacked, or dealing with having any sort of trauma in their life, dealing with depression. You know, like, these are all stuff that I think you can read and relate and really connect with the story and show that you can get out of it. You can live, you know, like you can go make great things, because this took place in the early 90s and we've had 20 years of amazing Paul Dini products, Paul Dini creations since then. So I think that's
what's a lot of good Paul Dini units.
Yes. Shipped a lot of SKUs.
At the same time, you know, he's been dealing with this for 20 something years.
Yeah.
And it hasn't gone away, and this kind of thing never fully does go away.
Yeah, now he's going to talk about it at cons. Think about that. Think about that further part of the risk.
Yeah.
But, like, you're at the table signing or whatever, and someone's like, I got attacked too, and you're like, oh, I'm going to have to live with this now. Which is good, and it's healthy, but it's taxing at the very least. It also made me think, I love autobiography comics and memoir, and I feel like I don't ever read any anymore.
You should dig deep in them. I think you should definitely, it can ignite a newfound love for autobiographic comics.
Yeah, I don't not love them. I just don't see them as much. I feel like that used to be the stock and trade of sort of indie comics, quote unquote, and that now that doesn't exist in the same way, like, I don't see them.
Right.
Yeah, but I would recommend this book for, you know, Paul Dini fans, for Batman the Animated Series fans, for fans of people who don't even like those things, but as, like Josh, like autobiographical comics. This hits a lot of different groups. It's a four-quadrant book is what I'm saying. But
children.
Do you have a chart? Do you have a chart that you could?
I really hope this book gets some attention come Eisner season. We always say that, and those books we talk about never do. But this done such a high level of quality. It's nice to see. It's nice to see that he can turn this much pain and torment into something so powerful and meaningful. I felt very moved by it. And as Ron said, you want to give him a hug, but obviously you don't want to because he doesn't want people touching him.
Which makes lots of sense. So Paul, if you're listening to this, we're giving you a virtual hug from our iFanboy family to yours.
And I don't want to patronize him either, but it's just he does a great job of God. I don't know if I could be this honest writing a book about myself. And this is not even just the mugging part, but as we said before, the stuff as a kid, the torment as a kid, and then the God. When I saw that scene at the Emmy,
the thing about it is that what I find really interesting is that in great distress and pain comes amazing art.
This is art.
This is art. This is truly art. This might be one of the greatest things he's done because, as great as Mad Love is and as great as that Batman run is and as great as everything that he's ever done, as great as He-Man was, as great as everything that he's done in the world of pop culture and animation and comics and TV and all stuff like that, this had heart. And not that stuff didn't have heart, but it had a person behind that heart that you could feel while reading it. And that's rare, especially in the 97 books that ship every week that are just rolling out the same tropes over and over again. To see something this honest and this raw, I think really should be celebrated.
From a guy who's a master of storytelling.
Yeah.
I imagine to a certain extent being this honest about it, being able to do it had a lot to do with feeling really, really confident about being the kind of storyteller who could do it justice, because if you don't do it right, then you're going to feel even worse.
Yeah.
But I assume this helped him. I assume this will help other people. I'm very, very glad that you made me read it.
Yeah, and if it doesn't get nominated for an Eisner, then we're just going to have to go down there and burn it.
We're not past that for this. You said it came out like 6 months ago.
Yes, it's going to be next year.
Out, so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I will say not to make a dumb joke. It's not a dumb joke. Those Emmys are fucking sharp.
No, I've touched one. I know they are. Yeah.
When I was reading that page, as I was flinching, I was also thinking, yeah, I can see that.
You've held an Emmy, right?
Well, yeah, I've won several of them.
Well, right, of course.
No, my friend's dad had one. He was an editor, and I used to always touch the wings because they were super sharp, and I was always as a kid fascinated by that.
I held Rod Serling's Emmy at college.
Well, that's right.
One of them. Because I was right place, right time.
They let you in that case?
They were clean. I was up there getting something signed by somebody, and they were cleaning the case. And so the case was open, and I said to the lady, I'm like, can I touch an Emmy? And she looked around. She's like, yeah, go for it. And so I said, okay. And I picked
up. Was it just a cleaning lady?
Yeah. Yes.
All right, for those who don't know, the Rod Serling archive was housed at the college the three of us went to.
Because he fit.
That's not okay. She shouldn't have that.
There was a display case with a bunch of his memorabilia, and including some of his Emmys, and apparently Ron broke into it.
I honestly was ready to root through it. I was going to see what I could take, but I didn't want to press my luck. I just picked up an Emmy. I went, oh, heavy. And put it back down.
It also explains the original copy of To Serve Manscript that you have. What? Don't tell me I can't throw some nerd shit around, by the way.
Good job.
Paul... To be honest, I thought it was a little obvious of a reference as far as episode choice, but
I think Paul Dini would be proud.
Yeah, he was a nerd.
By the way, I love the you can't say Woody Woodpecker, so I'm gonna call him something else.
Yeah.
And then that made me think, I'm like, oh man, what would a Paul Dini rebooted Woody Woodpecker been like? Would have been better than the crap they rolled out in the early 90s that he almost worked on.
It's funny, I read this originally when I got it, and I reread it today, just to have it fresh in my head. And with the passing of Gene Wilder, I just watched Blazing Saddles a couple days ago, and there's a joke on the final page that references it directly, but before he calls it out, I was like, oh, that's weird, that's the same dialogue from Blazing Saddles, that's odd. And then he says it is in the comic itself.
Yeah.
But
yeah, super nerd. Hey, listen, he had the back of a car couch.
I feel like this was, I think this is a department that Ron was working towards at one point.
At one point, yeah. I definitely... Yeah. He had the back, let that sink in, the back of a 57 Chevy couch. That's like straight out of Silver Spoons.
With that 80s reference, any final thoughts?
Nope.
All right.
Go read this. Go read it. Go to ifanboy.com/support, click on the Amazon button, and go order it.
I cannot recommend this more highly. I have no reservations on this one.
Yeah. Me either. Good job, Connor.
Dark Knight, a True Batman Story from Vertigo, written by Paul Dini, art by Eduardo Risso. Actually, they have an all-star team here. I think Todd Klein did the letters. Yeah, Todd Klein is on the letters, and Eduardo did the colors. Chip Kidd did the
Shelley Bond, editor.
Yep.
What a waste.
So go to fanboy.com. There'll be a post on the show. You can talk about this book if you've read it, and I hope you have. I don't feel like many people did. Like Ron said, there hasn't been a lot of talk about it. But hopefully after hearing this, you might go out and get it, although we've ruined all the surprises. Didn't give a spoiler warning. Whoops.
Oh.
Here's your spoiler warning. So check it out there. Then you can check out our weekly podcast, iFanboy Pick Week Podcast, where we talk about the week's releases. Every Sunday comes out. And so next month, you can look forward to a Talksplode.
Excited.
Maybe, Josh, you should interview Paul Dini.
I feel like I can't now. I feel like I know too much.
It'll be awkward, to say the least.
Yeah.
All right. Well, until then, until the next show, I am Connor.
I'm Ron.
And I'm Josh. Thanks. But you got that special kind of sadness. You got that tragic set of charms.